Let us turn in our Bibles this morning to Genesis chapter 16. Genesis 16, and we'll read the entire chapter. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. And she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, Behold, now the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, Behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, Thou God seest me. For she said, Have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Beer Leharoi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. Thus far, our text this morning is taken from the first 6 verses of this passage that we read, verses 1-6. Beloved congregation, the faith of God's people is often tested and tried. It was Peter in one of his epistles who, recognizing this fact, instructed the people that he wrote to not to even be surprised by this. Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you. Think of Job. How strenuously his faith was tried. Yet he said that he would come forth as gold, remember. James says that the trial of your faith works patience. Faith is often tried, and in all of the scriptures, I think we meet no one whose faith was as tried as Abram's, as we've been studying him. Over the past few months, we can do a quick review here and see the different ways in which his faith has been tested and tried. First, when he was called by the Lord from Ur of the Chaldees. He had to leave his familiar homeland and go to an unknown land. This was a trial of the sincerity of his faith. Did Abram love his God? more than his country, his home, his friends, and his family. Secondly, once he was in Canaan, you'll recall there was a famine in the land. And this was a trial of the sufficiency of Abram's faith. Would Abram look to the Lord to supply all of his needs, or would he depend on himself? It's the second trial. The third trial came when there was that strife between Abram and Lot's herdmen. You'll recall that event, and this was a trial of the humility of his faith. Would Abram assert his land rights as promised by God and so feed the fire, or would he submit himself and trust to the Lord? Fourth, when Lot and his family were taken captive by the armies of Chedorlaomer, this was a trial of the boldness of Abram's faith. Would Abram attempt a rescue? Or would he say, well, it's Lot's own fault and I'm not going to be that bold to go try to rescue him? We know what happened. Fifth, when the king of Sodom, on the return trip from the battle there in the north, he offered Abram all the battle spoil. Here was a test, a trial of the dignity of Abram's faith. Would Abram become a debtor to a Gentile, or would he continue to trust in the Lord? Well, we know what Abram did in these cases, congregation. He passed these tests by God's grace. But now we come to chapter 16 and we have another trial, this time of the patience of his faith. And Abram fails. It's a different story in this chapter. For the first time since returning from Egypt, Abram's faith faltered and even failed. Our theme this morning, with God's help, is Abram and Sarai's sinful plan to obtain an heir. Abram and Sarai's sinful plan to obtain an heir. And we'll see first the trial and logic leading up to this plan, and secondly also the trouble and the sorrow resulting from this plan. The trial and the logic that led to it, and the trouble and the sorrow that came of it. Children, imagine that your father promised you to give you your favorite longed for animal. Maybe for you it would be a beautiful black foal, a young horse. All your own to raise, to care for, to enjoy, and to call your own. And he says to you, I promise to give you a black foal. And then the first summer comes and goes and there is no horse. You ask, Dad, what about my horse? Yes, my child, I promise you I will buy you one. But then another summer goes by, and a third summer, five summers, eight, nine, 10 summers go by. Still no horse. What would you begin to think? You would begin to think that your father didn't actually mean what he promised you. This would be hard for you. You're now 10 years older. And you would probably begin to think, I'll never get my horse. Well, that's what Abram felt like. And Sarah too. God promised a son. And 10 years go by. Still no son. This is a trial for Abram and Sarah. God had given them a trial. It's a divine trial. We read in verse 1, now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. What a contrast. We didn't read it. But if you go back to chapter 15, verse 18, we read that in that same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. And then he mentions 10 nations. What a contrast. Abram, Sarai's wife, bear him no children. And just before that we read that Abram's offspring would be so great that they would replace, supplant the combined populations of 10 huge nations. staggering thought. But even more staggering to Abram and Sarai's faith was the ongoing reality of verse 1. Abram and Sarai had no children. Contrasting that great promise of God was the ongoing reality that they were barren. They didn't even have one, let alone 1 million. And time was moving on, and the longer it took, the less likely it seemed that a son would ever be born. And so, without question, this was a very hard trial for Abram and Sarai. They must have done a lot of thinking in those days, and one day we see the product of that thinking as Sarai approaches Abram and says in verse 2, "Behold, now the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I can obtain children by her." Sarah considers the possibility that Hagar, this Egyptian, might be a legitimate means to produce God's promised heir. Now we need to consider Sarah's logic from a human perspective. There's two thoughts here. The first thought is that her plan, though to us seems preposterous and ridiculous, was not preposterous. It was not unthinkable in their culture. This proposal was commonly practiced. Legally, in that day, a woman who could not have children could have them through her slave. This was socially accepted by virtue of culture and their laws. Think of Rachel a few generations later. There's Rachel. She too struggles to have children, and her maid Bilhah gives birth upon Rachel's knees to give the impression that it was Rachel's child, a form of surrogacy. And there Jacob does it. It's a social norm. The second consideration is that up until now, God had not said that Sarai would be the mother of Abram's promised seed. God had only said that Abram would have a son. And so these two things lead Sarai, after much thinking, to propose this proposal of verse 2. But in spite of these considerations from a human perspective, congregation, this plan was a sinful plan. And there are four reasons for that. And the first reason is that it operated contrary to God's revealed will. This proposal might have been acceptable by virtue of culture and their law, but it was unacceptable by virtue of creation and their Lord. This human social norm, this law, did not override God's law. From the beginning of the creation, it was not so. God made them male and female, one man and one woman, and that sacred marriage bond may not be intruded upon by another, with or without consent. That's adultery. And that is contrary to God's law encoded in the creation ordinance of marriage. And that's what Abram and Sarai forgot. This truth that God had made things in this order from the beginning began to pale in comparison to how long this was taking and how legal this all seemed. Well, here's a lesson for us, congregation, that conformity to this world and to this world's standards and losing sight of God's law is dangerous business. It will invariably lead to sin and fault and failure. We ought to always remember that we ought to obey God rather than men. The second reason this was a sinful plan is because they did not seek God's guidance. We don't read that Abram said, "Okay, well, let's lay this before the Lord for a month, for 6 months." No. They took matters into their own hands, relying on their human reasoning. The third reason this was a sinful plan is because they misread God's providence. Sarai simply deduced from the fact that since she was old and since the Lord had not given her any children, it must not be the Lord's will for her to have any children. But that's faulty thinking, because just because the Lord withholds something from you does not mean that he does not want you to have it. It may simply mean that he doesn't want you to have it right now. Children, back to that example we started with. It's been 10 years. Maybe you got the promise when you were 7 or 8. Your father wants you to be 19 or 20 before he buys you that horse. The promise is still in effect. It's just not right now. So it is here. Sarai thought the Lord was saying no, when in fact all he was saying was not yet. Misreading God's providence. And then fourthly, the fourth reason this was a sinful plan is because it introduced a human contribution to the fulfillment of God's gracious covenant. They had the covenant. God, you'll recall from last time, had just cut that covenant with Abram in such a remarkable way. Remember how he'd walked through those pieces as that smoking furnace and that burning lamp, by himself, alone. And Abram didn't go through. That was to teach Abram and all of us too that we have nothing whatsoever that we can contribute to God's covenant. We can't meet its obligations and we can't contribute to it in any way. But here Abram and Sarai act as though they've walked through between those pieces and they act as though they can contribute to that covenant. Trying to speed things up. It's almost as though they were saying to one another, look, the Lord has painted himself into a corner. Due to our age, we can no longer bear children. And so there's the Lord. He's stuck. We'll help the Lord help us. This, of course, is totally wrong. We cannot help God help us. We cannot contribute toward the fulfillment of his word and his promises. All we are called to do is to hear them, to believe them, and to plead them, and to wait patiently for him to work them out. There's something else here that we can see in Sarai's plan. It's not a reason per se, but it's something in the way Sarah says what she says. Notice what she doesn't say. She doesn't say, Abram, let's do this plan so that you may have children by Hagar. She doesn't say that. She says that I may obtain children by her. That I may be built up, the original says. Here she was, it seems she's looking to herself. Maybe she's also looking to Abram and ultimately to the Lord's promise. And maybe we have to be careful about being too hard on Sarai, but it's wrong, even the way she says it. Then it's surprising, isn't it, congregation, when we read those words that the father of all the faithful, that patriarch, he agrees with Sarai. Verses 2 and 3, we read, and Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. Here's another contrast. In chapter 15, verse 6, we read those remarkable words where here, as the scriptures are unfolding, we have a high water mark. As we learn of justification by faith, as we've been studying in our catechism, there it says Abram believed in the Lord, and it was accounted, imputed to him for righteousness. He believed in the Lord. Now we read a low water mark. And he believed in Sarai. He hearkened to the voice of Sarai. Only a chapter before, Abram was walking according to the Spirit. Now Abram's walking according to the flesh. And this is what Paul brings out in Galatians chapter 4. There, these Judaizers had come to the Galatians and they had said, oh, it's wonderful that you believe in Christ. But you cannot get to heaven if you're not also believing and doing the works of the law. The Mosaic law was infiltrated into Paul's gospel, and they had turned it into another gospel, and they had said, faith plus works. Yes, believe in Christ, that's great, but be circumcised. Focus on these works of the law. And Paul comes in swinging in his epistle, and he says, O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you? What is this? There in chapter 4, he takes this very picture of walking according to the Spirit and according to the flesh, this picture of Sarai and Hagar. He says there was there in the days of the patriarchs, there was the son of the slave woman who was born of the flesh. And later there was that son of the free woman, Isaac, who was born of the promise. He says these things are an allegory. They typify. They represent two covenants. Hagar, the covenant of works, Mount Sinai, and Sarai, the covenant of grace, Mount Zion. And he makes the point so clearly that those who seek to earn their salvation by the works of the law, like those Judaizers are trying to do to you Galatians, or like so many do even today, they are children of the flesh. Those who seek to be saved by faith apart from the works of the law are the children of promise, and we'll explore this a little more this afternoon, Lord willing, as our catechism takes us now from justification into what role do good works play? What are there any works that can contribute to our justification? It's amazing how in God's providence our morning and our afternoon services have lined up so well. So by the light of Paul's own interpretation in Galatians 4, Abram in this chapter is acting according to the flesh. And that will always lead to trouble and to sorrow. We see that secondly. What happens? Well, as the story unfolds, the fruit of this rash, this impatient, this unfaithful and sinful plan are quickly tasted. This plan, the adoption of this plan, sets in motion immediate trouble and sorrow, and also perpetual trouble and sorrow. First, immediate trouble there in Abram's tent. And secondly, perpetual trouble, even today, by setting in motion a centuries-long conflict between Arabs and Jews. Now, if Abram was alive today, he might well be the saddest man on earth. That may be an overstatement because, first of all, he's not alive today, but he might there see all his children of Ishmael, all his children of Isaac, in constant conflict. What a thing. And yet, there from his perspective in heaven, as it were, Abram would know even today that this too was in the Lord's providence, and that he'll guide all things according to his sovereign counsel. But this plan brings nothing but trouble. We see trouble and sorrow between Hagar and Sarai. Hagar conceives, and when she realizes that she has conceived and is expecting a child, she despises Sarai, her mistress. She begins to treat Sarah with contempt. She begins to look down on her. She probably made some rude comments to her. Who do you think you are asking me to do that? I'm the one bearing an heir here, you know. Think of Peninnah tormenting Hannah, or Leah tormenting Rachel. There she is tormenting Sarai. She makes her feel inferior. Hagar was quickly trying to unseat Sarai as the primary matriarch. What trouble. Sarai feels this and grows more and more upset. Instead of turning straight to Hagar, she goes to Abram, and she begins to shift blame and find reason to blame her husband. There's trouble and sorrow, secondly, between Sarai and Abram. My wrong be upon thee, she says. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. And she says this, the Lord judge between me and thee. This is all your fault, Abram. Maybe Sarai thought or saw that Abram was being favorable to Hagar, thinking that the plan had worked and that this was going to turn out marvelously well after all. And so Sarai felt sidelined and betrayed and offended, and jealousy set in, and jealousy turned to anger and hatred and led her to burst out to Abram, "The Lord will show who's wrong, you or me." But rather than blame Abram, she should have blamed herself. This was her plan, this was her idea. But as often happens, when we are angry and upset, congregation, we're not thinking straight. And Sarai was not thinking rationally. Does all this sound familiar? Sometimes we can get so angry or upset, we lash out in accusation against those around us. And often later we regret our words. And then the best thing to do is to humbly go to that person and to eat that humble pie and to apologize for your behavior. Even if you've had to do so before, do it again. Say sorry. Don't feed the fires of conflict with more conflict. Seek to quench them with love, quench them with humility, quench them with forgiveness. Our anger is often sinful, just as Sarai's anger was sinful. She had no right to tell Abram off like that. And she certainly had no right to bring the Lord into it, to invoke the name of the Lord. She's ultimately taking God's name in vain. But that's not the only trouble we see here, congregation. Then there's more trouble, thirdly, in Abram's response to her. Instead of taking charge of the situation like a man and admitting his mistake, he slinks away with tail tucked under. He says to Sarai, "She's your maid, deal with her." What a cop-out. He forgoes his authority and he gives it to Sarai. Hagar was his wife now. By right, she deserved his protection. But he gives Sarai permission to tear a chunk out of her, and it's possible that she did, even physically. Whip her. We don't know. We read, she dealt hardly with her. Sarai began to vent her wrath upon Hagar. And it wasn't just a little bit. And it wasn't just for a little time. Because this went on. And finally Hagar had enough. She began to plot and to scheme an escape. When I get the opportunity, I'll gather a few things and I'll disappear. And I'll head southwest. Familiar country. I'm from Egypt. I'll head back there. I know the river crossing. Soon I'll be back with my family, with somebody I know. Maybe she had nobody she knew and she thought, I'll just hit the streets. I'll find a life for myself. Maybe we think, good, go Hagar, go Hagar. But no, that was wrong too. Nothing but trouble and sorrow. Let's look at three lessons we learned from this congregation as we close. First, the prevalence of sin after grace. Let's not lose sight of this fact that Abram and Sarai were children of God. They had been bought with a price. And somehow, as we read these six verses, in our minds, we sort of put that on hold. As we dive into the gutter of their sin, we sort of separate that truth from the picture. These things are too irreconcilable, too different. The world's apart, their converted state and their actions here. But the one is not placed on hold while the other plays out for a moment. No, these two things, grace and sin, are concurrent realities in the life of every child of God. Grace and sin do dwell together. They are intricately meshed even in so many ways, in frustrating ways, but in real ways. It was Paul's lament that he was a wretch of a man. That wasn't theory, congregation. That wasn't something that he'd learned by some reading in a book. No, it was painful, practical experience for Paul. Child of God, here, has that been your painful, practical experience too, that you are at the same time as you are a child of God, also the chief of sinners? You felt that sin so persistent, so continual, always assailing and assaulting you. The longer you have dealings with it, the more you see that it never pays its promised wages, and you loathe yourself for it. Oh, sin is a terrible thing. But it's an ongoing reality. In the life of every believer until the day he or she dies. But be encouraged. Even in the face of that, for when you love the Lord, then sin may trip you up and cause you to doubt and maybe sometimes even despair. You may fall with Abram, David, or Peter. But Paul says in Romans 6, that sin shall not have dominion over you. It's present, yes, but it's present at the foot of the throne, no longer on the seat of the throne. It doesn't reign supreme anymore. Christ does, and so fight on. Don't lose heart. We see here the prevalence of sin after grace. But second lesson is that we also see the destructive effects of our sin. Look at this mess before us, congregation. If we learn nothing else this morning, let us learn that sin is ugly, it destroys, it guts the core out of relationships, it kills, it harms, it poisons. If you've been playing with sin in your life, if you're tempted of the devil, yes, drawn away of your own evil, sinful lusts, to follow this or that sin, be warned, sin will only hurt you. It's the most damaging thing in the world. This past week near Pittsburgh, I couldn't help but read this headline and then read a little further. A little girl told her bus driver that she couldn't wake her parents up that morning. So she got dressed herself and went to school anyway. Well, the driver alerted the police, who later found them dead from a drug overdose, with three other children in the home. See the destructive nature of sin. See it here in this chapter. See it in the world around us. Do you see it in your life too? Does it grieve you? Does it leave you like Abram and Sarai at the end of verse 6? You say, where? That's not there. It's not written. But it doesn't take too much to imagine what they must have been thinking after Hagar left. After things had calmed down, and they began to have regrets. It's not revealed. But as we often do, after things have calmed down, they must have turned to saner and more nobler thoughts. Maybe Abram said, after days of silence and thinking, it's all my fault, dear. No, Abram, it's all my fault. I'm so sorry for this mess. Now she's gone. We're back to where we started. What have I done? What have I done? You ever felt like that? And the destructive effects of your sin grieve you. And you realize you need grace. That's the third lesson, the goodness and the grace of God in spite of that sin. Nothing that anybody has said or done up till now in this chapter has been good. These six verses are verses of impatience, of unbelief, of fleshly reasoning, foolishness, adultery, infighting, betrayal, marital strife, blaspheming, abdication of authority, anger, cruelty, murder, hatred, rejection, abandonment, and rebellion. It's all wrong. It's all sinful until we come to verse 7. And the angel of the Lord found her. Finally, something good happens. And it's not because of Abram, Sarai, or Hagar. It's because of someone else. Someone else acts. Someone none other than God appearing as the pre-incarnate Christ, not to Abram this time, not even to Sarah, but to a poor, sinful, abused Egyptian slave girl. This is the first time something good happens, and from here on it will start to get better again. What is that? It's God's marvelous, undeserved grace and goodness. Here comes God on a rescue mission into the wilderness of Shur to right wrongs, to correct mistakes, to reunite enemies, and to shed abroad his love into Abram's tent again. Oh, they may weep today, but they will laugh. You wait. Because God. He's your only hope, my friend. Whether you're saved or unsaved this morning, Abram and Sarai needed God and his grace in this dark hour. Hagar needed his grace in this dark hour. You need his grace in your dark hours. You need it. Not just a supplement. It's everything. He's willing to give it. He's able to dispense it to you because here came God on a rescue mission as he sent his son into the wilderness of sin to suffer and to die. Friends, from out of the ashes of this dark history rises the cross of Christ. Do you see it? Magnificent cross. Blessed cross. Cross of God's grace and goodness for the one who died there. Can pay for all your sins, past, present, and future. All manner of sins. Abram and Sarai will taste that grace of God soon. For now, as they're in their tent, they don't see it yet. But it's coming to them from the wilderness of Shur, as their slave servant is now hurrying back to their tent at the command of the Lord. And when they see her, they say nothing. They can't, because she is full. She tells them everything. They stand still together at the intervening grace of God. It's the grace we all need, congregation, for God to intervene, to show his grace, to guide us in his ways. Let us ask him for this grace today and every day. Amen.